Welcome to the Audio Bookworm, broadcast regularly on WEHC 90.7, your college and community station. I'm your host, Rob Chamberlain, and today, special voice guest artist Harry Baia and I continue our reading from A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. In our last reading, Ebenezer Scrooge, on a journey of redemption with three spirits, has, with the ghost of Christmas present, joined the Christmas celebration at the home of his clerk, Bob Cratchit, where he learns that the family does not really care much for him, although they do him the honor of drinking a toast in his name. For his part, Scrooge finds himself strangely affected by the health of Bob Cratchit's youngest son, the lame Tiny Tim. Setting forth, the ghost of Christmas present ranges far and wide throughout the world to bring Christmas joy to all struggling people. Suddenly, Scrooge finds himself at the Christmas celebration at the home of his nephew, where his nephew expresses genuine affection for his uncle. The family's celebrations include a number of games, especially Blind Man's Bluff, which serves as an excuse to unite two young lovers of the party. Scrooge's niece was not one of the Blind Man's Buff party, but was made comfortable with a large chair and a footstool in a snug corner where the ghost and Scrooge were close behind her. But she joined in the forfeits and loved her love to admiration with all the letters of the alphabet. Likewise, at the game of how, when, and where, she was very great, and, to the secret joy of Scrooge's nephew, beat her sisters hollow, though they were sharp girls too, as Topper could have told you. There might have been 20 people there, young and old, but they all played, and so did Scrooge, for wholly forgetting in the interest he had in what was going on, that his voice made no sound in their ears, he sometimes came out with his guess quite loud, and very often guessed quite right, too, for the sharpest needle, best Whitechapel, warranted not to cut in the eye, was not sharper than Scrooge, blunt as he took it in his head to be. The ghost was greatly pleased to find him in this mood, and looked upon him with such favor that he begged like a boy to be allowed to stay until the guests departed. But this, the spirit said, could not be done.
"Here is a new game," said Scrooge. "One half-hour, spirit, only one."
It was a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something, and the rest must find out what. He only answering to their questions, yes or no, as the case was. The brisk fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited from him that he was thinking of an animal, a live animal, rather a disagreeable animal, a savage animal, an animal that growled and grunted sometimes, and talked sometimes, and lived in London, and walked about the streets, and wasn't made a show of, and wasn't led by anybody, and didn't live in a menagerie, and was never killed in a market, and was not a horse, or an ass, or a cow, or a bull, or a tiger, or a dog, or a pig, or a cat, or a bear. At every fresh question that was put to him, this nephew burst into a fresh roar of laughter, and was so inexpressibly tickled that he was obliged to get up off the sofa and stamp. At last, the plump sister, falling into a similar state, cried out,
"I have found out! I know what it is, Fred! I know what it is!"
"What is it?" cried Fred.
"It's your Uncle Scrooge!"
Which it certainly was. Admiration was the universal sentiment, though some objected to the reply that, "Is it a bear?" ought to have been yes, inasmuch as an answer in the negative was sufficient to have diverted their thoughts from Mr. Scrooge, supposing they had ever had any tendency in that way.
"He has given us plenty of merriment, I am sure," said Fred, "and it would be ungrateful not to drink his health. Here is a glass of mulled wine ready to our hand at the moment, and I say, Uncle Scrooge."
"Well, Uncle Scrooge," they cried.
"A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to the old man, whatever he is," said Scrooge's nephew. "He wouldn't take it from me, but he may have it, nevertheless. Uncle Scrooge."
Uncle Scrooge had imperceptibly become so gay and light of heart
that he would have pledged the unconscious company in return, and thanked them in an inaudible speech if the ghost had given him time. But the whole scene passed off in the breath of the last word spoken by his nephew, and he and the spirit were again upon their travels. Much they saw, and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy end. The spirits stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful, on foreign lands, and they were close at home, by struggling men, and they were patient in their greater hope, by poverty, and it was rich, in almshouse, hospital, and jail, in misery's every refuge, where vain man, in his little brief authority, had not made fast the door, and barred the spirit out. He left his blessing, and taught Scrooge his precepts. It was a long night, if it were only a night, but Scrooge had his doubts of this, because the Christmas holidays appeared to be condensed into the space of time they passed together. It was strange, too, that while Scrooge remained unaltered in his outward form, the ghost grew older, clearly older. Scrooge had observed this change, but never spoke of it until they left a children's Twelfth Night party, when, looking at the spirit as they stood together in an open place, he noticed that its hair was gray.
"Are spirits' lives so short?" asked Scrooge.
"My life upon this globe is very brief," replied the ghost. "It ends to-night."
"To-night?" cried Scrooge.
"To-night, at midnight. Hark! The time is drawing near."
The chimes were ringing the 11:15 at that moment.
"Forgive me, I am not justified in what I ask," said Scrooge, looking intently at the spirit's robe. "But I see something strange, and not belonging to yourself, protruding from your skirt. Is it a foot or a claw?"
"It might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it,"
was the spirit's sorrowful reply.
"Look here."
From the foldings of its robe, it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment.
"No, man, look here. Look, look down there," exclaimed the ghost.
They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate, too, in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade. Through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible in dread. Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude.
"Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more.
"They are man's," said the spirit, looking down upon them. "And they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Deny it,"
cried the spirit, stretching out its hand toward the city.
"Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your factious purposes, and make it worse. Then bide the end."
"Have they no refuge or resource?" cried Scrooge.
"Are there no prisons?"
said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words.
"Are there no workhouses?"
The bells struck 12. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost, and saw it not. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground, towards him. Stave 4. The Last of the Spirits. The phantom slowly, gravely, silently approached. When it came near him, Scrooge bent down upon his knee, for in the very air through which this spirit moved, it seemed to scatter gloom and mystery. It was shrouded in a deep black garment, which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. But for this, it would have been difficult to detach its figure from the night and separate it from the darkness by which it was surrounded. He felt that it was tall and stately when it came beside him, and that its mysterious presence filled him with a solemn dread. He knew no more, for the spirit neither spoke nor moved.
"I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come," said Scrooge.
The spirit answered not, but pointed onward with its hand.
"You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened, but will happen in the time before us," Scrooge pursued. "Is that so, spirit?"
The upper portion of the garment was contracted for an instant in its folds, as if the spirit had inclined its head. That was the only answer he received. Although well used to ghostly company by this time, Scrooge feared the silent shape so much that his legs trembled beneath him, and he found that he could hardly stand when he prepared to follow it. The spirit paused a moment, as observing his condition, and giving him time to recover. But Scrooge was all the worse for this. It thrilled him with a vague, uncertain horror to know that behind the dusky shroud there were ghostly eyes intently fixed upon him, while he, though he stretched his own to the utmost, could see nothing but a spectral hand and one great heap of black.
"Ghost of the future," he explained, "I fear you more than any specter I have seen. But as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?"
It gave him no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them.
"Lead on," said Scrooge. "Lead on. The night is waning fast, and it's precious time to me. I know. Lead on, spirit."
The phantom moved away as it had come towards him. Scrooge followed in the shadow of its dress, which bore him up, he thought, and carried him along. They scarcely seemed to enter the city, for the city rather seemed to spring up about them and encompass them of its own act. But there they were, in the heart of it, on change, amongst the merchants who hurried up and down and chinked the money in their pockets and conversed in groups and looked at their watches and trifled thoughtfully with their great gold seals and so forth, as Scrooge had seen them often. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
"No," said a great fat man with a monstrous chin. "I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead."
"When did he die?"
inquired another.
"Last night, I believe."
"Why, what was the matter with him?"
asked a third, taking a vast quantity of snuff out of a very large snuff box.
"I thought he'd never die."
"God knows,"
said the first, with a yawn.
"What has he done with his money?"
asked a red-faced gentleman with a pendulous excrescence on the end of his nose that shook like the gills of a turkey-cock.
"I haven't heard," said the man with a large chin, yawning again. "Left it to his company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me, that's all I know."
This pleasantry was received with a general laugh.
"It's likely to be a very cheap funeral," said the same speaker, "for upon my life, I don't know anybody to go to it. Suppose we make up a party and volunteer."
"I don't mind going if a lunch is provided,"
observed the gentleman with the excrescence on his nose.
"But I must be fed if I make one."
Another laugh.
Well, I am the most disinterested among you, after all, said the first speaker, for I never wear black gloves, and I never eat lunch, but I'll offer to go, if anybody else will. When I come to think of it, I'm not at all sure that I wasn't his most particular friend, for we used to stop and speak whenever we met. Bye-bye.
Speakers and listeners strolled away and mixed with other groups. Scrooge knew the men and looked towards the spirit for an explanation. The phantom glided on into a street. Its finger pointed to two persons meeting. Scrooge listened again, thinking that the explanation might lie here. He knew these men also perfectly. They were men of business, very wealthy, and of great importance. He had made a point always of standing well in their esteem. In a business point of view, that is, strictly in a business point of view.
"How are you?"
said one.
"How are you?"
returned the other.
"Well,"
said the first,
"Old Scratch has got his own at last, eh?"
"So I am told,"
returned the second.
"Cold, isn't it?"
"Seasonable, for Christmas time. You're not a skater, I suppose?"
"No, no. Something else to think of. Good morning."
Not another word. That was their meeting, their conversation, and their parting. Scrooge was at first inclined to be surprised that the spirit should attach importance to conversations apparently so trivial, but feeling assured that they must have some hidden purpose, he set himself to consider what it was likely to be. They could scarcely be supposed to have any bearing on the death of Jacob, his old partner, for that was past, and this ghost's province was the future. Nor could he think of anyone immediately connected with himself to whom he could apply them. But nothing doubting that, to whomsoever they applied, they had some latent moral for his own improvement, he resolved to treasure up every word he heard and everything he saw, and especially to observe the shadow of himself when it appeared, for he had an expectation that the conduct of his future self would give him the clue he missed, and would render the solution of these riddles easy. He looked about in that very place for his own image, but another man stood in his accustomed corner, and though the clock pointed to his usual time of day for being there, he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes that poured in through the porch. It gave him little surprise, however, for he had been revolving in his mind a change of life, and thought and hoped he saw his newborn resolutions carried out in this. Quiet and dark, beside him stood the phantom, with its outstretched hand. When he roused himself from his thoughtful quest, he fancied from the turn of the hand and its situation in reference to itself that the unseen eyes were looking at him keenly. It made him shudder and feel very cold. They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge had never penetrated before, although he recognized its situation and its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people half-naked, drunken, slipshod, ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell and dirt and life upon the straggling streets, and the whole quarter reeked with crime, with filth and misery. Far in this den of infamous resort, there was a low-browed beetling shop below a penthouse roof where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. Upon the floor within were piled up heaps of rusty keys, nails, chains, hinges, files, scales, weights, and refuse iron of all kinds. Secrets that few would like to scrutinize were bred and hidden in mountains of unseemly rags, masses of corrupted fat, and sepulchres of bones. Sitting in among the wares he dealt in, by a charcoal stove made of old bricks, was a gray-haired rascal, nearly 70 years of age, who had screened himself from the cold air without by a frowsy curtaining of miscellaneous tatters hung upon a line, and smoked his pipe in all the luxury of calm retirement. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man, just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop.
but she had scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black, who was no less startled by the sight of them than they had been by the recognition of each other. After a short period of blank astonishment, in which the old man with a pipe had joined them, they all three burst into a laugh.
"Let the chairwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we haven't all three met here without meaning it."
"You couldn't have met in a better place," said old Joe, removing his pipe from his mouth. "Come into the parlour. You were made free of it long ago, you know. And the other two aren't strangers. Stop till I shut the door of the shop. Oh, how it squeaks. There ain't such a rusty bit of metal in the place as its own hinges, I believe. And I'm sure there's no such old bones ears as mine. We're all suitable to our calling. We're well matched. Come into the parlour. Come into the parlour."
The parlour was the space behind the screen of rags. The old man raked the fire together with an old stair-rod, and having trimmed his smoky lamp, for it was night, with the stem of his pipe, put it in his mouth again. While he did this, the woman, who had already spoken, threw her bundle on the floor, and sat down in a flaunting manner on a stool, crossing her elbows on her knees, and looking with a bold defiance at the other two.
"What odds, then? What odds, Mrs. Dilber?"
said the woman.
"Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did." "That's true, indeed,"
said the laundress.
"No man more so. Why, then, don't stand staring as if you was afraid, woman. Who's the wiser? We're not going to pick holes in each other's coats, I suppose."
"No, indeed,"
said Mrs. Dilber and the man together.
"We should hope not." "Very well, then,"
cried the woman.
"That's enough. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose?"
"No, indeed,"
said Mrs. Dilber, laughing.
"If he had wanted to keep 'em after he was dead, a wicked old screw,"
pursued the woman,
"why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death, instead of lying, gasping out his life there, alone by himself."
"That's the truest word that ever was spoke,"
said Miss Dilber.
"It's a judgment on him." "I wish it was a little heavier judgment,"
replied the woman.
"And it should have been. You may depend upon it. If I could have laid my hands on anything else. Open that bundle, old Joe, and let me know the value of it. Speak out plain. I'm not afraid to be the first, nor afraid for them to see it. We know pretty well that we were helping ourselves before we met here, I believe. It's no sin. Open the bundle, Joe."
But the gallantry of her friends would not allow of this, and the man in faded black, mounting the breech first, produced his plunder. It was not extensive. A seal or two, a pencil case, a pair of sleeve buttons, and a brooch of no great value were all. They were severally examined and appraised by old Joe, who chalked the sums he was disposed to give for each upon the wall, and adding them up into a total when he found that there was nothing more to come.
"That's your account," said Joe. "I wouldn't give another sixpence if I was to be boiled for not doing it. Who's next?"
Mrs. Dilber was next. Sheets and towels, a little wearing apparel, two old-fashioned silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs, and a few boots. Her account was stated on the wall in the same manner.
"I always give too much to ladies. It's a weakness of mine, and that's the way I ruin myself," said old Joe. "That's your account. If you asked me for another penny, it made me an open question. I'd repent of being so liberal and knock off half a crown."
"And now undo my bundle, Joe,"
said the first woman. Joe went down on his knees for the greater convenience of opening it, and having unfastened a great many knots, dragged out a large and heavy roll of some dark stuff.
"What do you call this?" said Joe. "Bed curtains?"
"Ah,"
returned the woman, laughing and leaning forward on her crossed arms.
"Bed curtains!
You don't mean to say you took 'em down rings and all with him lying there?" said Joe.
"Yes, I do," replied the woman. "Why not?"
"You were born to make your fortune," said Joe, "and you certainly do it."
"I certainly shan't hold my hand when I can get anything in it by reaching out for the sake of such a man as he was. I promise you, Joe,"
returned the woman coolly.
"Don't drop that oil upon the blankets now."
"Is blankets?" asked Joe.
"Whose else's do you think?"
replied the woman.
"Isn't likely to take cold without 'em, I dare say."
"I hope he didn't die of anything catching, eh?" said old Joe, stopping at his work and looking up.
"Don't you be afraid of that,"
returned the woman.
"I ain't so fond of his company that I'd loiter about him for such things if he did. Ah, you may look through that shirt till your eyes ache, but you won't find a hole in it, nor a threadbare place. It's the best he had, and a fine one, too. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't been for me."
"What do you call wasting it?" asked old Joe.
"Putting it on him to be buried in, to be sure,"
replied the woman with a laugh.
"Somebody was fool enough to do it, but I took it off again. If calico ain't good enough for such a purpose, it isn't good enough for anything. It's quite as becoming to the body. He can't look uglier than he did in that one."
Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror. As they sat grouped about their spoil, in the scanty light afforded by the old man's lamp, he viewed them with a detestation and disgust which could hardly have been greater, though they had been obscene demons marketing the corpse itself. Laughed the same woman, when old Joe, producing a flannel bag with money in it, told out their several gains upon the ground.
"This is the end of it, you see. He frightened everyone away from him when he was alive to profit us when he was dead."
"Spirit," said Scrooge, shuddering from head to foot. I see. The case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heaven, what is this?"
He recoiled in terror, for the scene had changed, and now he almost touched a bed. A bare, uncurtained bed, on which, beneath a ragged sheet, there lay something covered up, which, though it was dumb, announced itself in awful language. At this particular point, with Scrooge having left the presence of human vultures, who obviously profit from the deaths and sorrows of others, and yet now having found himself probably in the presence of the very person about whom those same vultures were speaking, we must unfortunately pause, for we have reached the end of our allotted time for today's reading from A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Please join Harry Baya and me for our next reading. Until then, this is Rob Chamberlain, your host for the Audio Bookworm.